I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Shimutai Lashin. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here with you today.
Well, I'm really glad we're able to talk about your new book, I Am Ma and Other Stories. Do I pronounce it Mao or more? What's the proper pronunciation?
It's Mao. Mao, taken from the name of a Mao forest. Not to be confused with the Mau Mau, because many, when you look for it or something, you have the Mau Mau of Kenya. That was the freedom fighters during the time of colonial against the British. So it's not that. It's Mao.
We'll come to the in that sense, the named story. Mm-hmm. In the book, I Am the Mau, which I found had so many parallels for my experiences working with Indigenous people in Australia and the loss of country. But there's so much else in this book. I mean, it's infused with human rights, with political questions. It has kids being brought up and relating to their parents. There's so much going on. Where did the idea for all of this come from? I imagine it has a lot to do with your own upbringing in Kenya. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it comes, actually, I'd have to go all the way back to about 2007 when I wrote my very first story. It's not included in this collection. When I first wrote that story, I was responding to a situation that I found myself in. I'd gone to visit my family for Christmas, and then there was an election, and then the results didn't go well. And then we found ourselves in this really strange place where violence broke out. And in just trying to deal with that, because for me, that hit me hard, mostly because I'd always read about it, seen violence on TV, but I'd never really witnessed it. And seeing how close family members came close to that point of being attacked themselves, this made me think about what I can do about this situation. And for me at the time, thinking, I'm a teacher, I'm a parent, I'm surrounded by young people. How do you even deal with this? And I just wanted to be able to contribute something to that conversation. And so I wrote my first book, my first story, and I was just exploring that situation, the human rights issues that were coming up in that. And it's after I finished that story that I thought, oh, my story is not finished. There's so many more things I could be talking about. And I just felt like I now believed I could actually write, because it's one thing to think you want to write or to dream about writing, but to actually get a story in one place and it's a beautiful story and you go, wow, so I can write. And so I started exploring other issues. Yeah.
Now, many of our listeners will know about Kenya. They'll have a rough idea of where it is in Africa, and they might even have a better idea about its, if you like, its geopolitical situation. But just give us all a quick précis. How many people live in Kenya? What's the ethnic divisions? In a sense, what is the politics of the place?
Actually, before we even think of politics, most people associate Kenya with the marathon runners. We have produced a lot of great runners from that region. So when the Olympics come around, that's when Kenya gets put on the map. And then, of course, we always like to connect ourselves to Obama. You know, we are proud to be associated with that because his father was born in Kenya. And that is, you know, so there are certain things that we just like to connect ourselves with if I speak as a Kenyan now. But it's about 50 something million people. It's relatively, actually, compared to many countries, we're quite democratic in our politics, but we're also very vocal and very, we have a lot of young people. I think the majority of the population is quite young, so it has a lot of potential. You know, great things are happening. The infrastructure is improving every single day. I get surprised every time I go back to see how much more is happening. IT, you know, everybody just seems to be more digitally aware, more than I even expected to experience. So it is coming a long way. So, and relatively peaceful compared to the others. But our young people are very vocal about their politics there.
And your own career, where you got to the point doing a PhD and wanting to write, what was the evolution of that?
I was a teacher. I've been a teacher. I arrived in Australia about 25 years ago, but before that, I've been teaching in Kenya for 5 years. So I've always been around young people, and I've taught for, you know, all these years, mostly teaching English and literature and such related topics and subjects. And then, I think about, after I just had my child, I thought, oh, yeah, I think I have a bit of time now. You know, if I've managed to work and raise a child, I think there's room in me to do a little bit more. So I went back to study. But this time I was interested in doing something. I didn't want to study something along education lines because I felt like I wanted something different. So I started studying human rights. And then by the time I was finishing my master's, then I was sort of thinking, oh, yeah, I wanted to think creatively about how to think about human rights and the work that I was doing as a teacher. Yeah. So this is sort of has all come together that way.
Well, I have to tell you that I have just loved reading. I am another stories. I've really been blown away in some of the reviews or marketing of the book. It says this is for young adults. And I think, oh, I'm pleased I'm a young adult. I'm just 73. And I think, well, perhaps the definition of a young adult is, in fact, narrower than that. But this, for me, is a book for young adults, their parents, their grandparents, all their friends and their friends and their friends. You manage to set up issues and have me on the edge of my seat. I'm not sure what's going to happen. Take the story about beading, which is in about the middle of it all. Tell our readers a little bit, our listeners a little bit about that, because there's a lot of tension in that story.
I will admit that was the most difficult of the stories that I had to write. The subject is quite heavy. And just as I mentioned to you before we started this, that when I was writing this, I was writing within the context of a teacher communicating with in a classroom. And that's why we're thinking of it as in terms of young adults. But the issues in there are not necessarily just limited to young people. But this particular story, actually, I was inspired by a young woman from a community that has that practice. And she was in her 20s at the time and trying to rescue girls. Beating is the closest I can describe beating is, you know, child marriage. Think of it as child brides. So she was rescuing her. She rescued her, I think it was her cousin, and then who came along with her friend. And then it occurred to her that she can do more and start rescuing a lot of girls out of this situation. So yes, that was quite difficult, mostly because it's a very difficult topic, yet it's happening to young people. It's happening to basically children, you know? So I had to be careful in the way I was writing, because when you write about young people, but the reality is these are young people dealing with very adult situations. So it gets really, really tricky. At the same time, because it's not my own community that I'm talking about, it's not from my own personal experience. So I also had to respect the fact that this is the culture of a particular people. So I wanted to approach it with respect. At the same time, trying to have that conversation about, should this really still be happening? There's a lot of work that's actually going into that field. Like I said, I was inspired by this young girl. Her name is Josephine Claire. And there is some improvement, but it's taking time. It's taking time for that to really sink in. So sometimes we do have those situations where our right to practice our culture is in conflict with the right for a child not to come to harm. So, yeah. You can't find parallels other parts of the world with similar harmful cultures, harmful practices.
And that's a story that will resonate, going back to my earlier comment about a young adult. Mm-hmm. It's not only with young adults who will be faced with it, but people like me are both learning about East African cultures, those ethnic questions, and we see them in Australia in different contexts, but it's both fabulous writing, highly instructional, and does everything you want it to do it. And there's another story. I mean, you go to things that make you laugh. I think it's of hare and goats, the story about a girl who doesn't want to have to keep a hare at the inch long level that the principal says, but she thinks perhaps a Maasai Mara type haircut might give a go, even though she's not Maasai.
Yes.
Really interesting. It's like a young Australian European kid wanting to have a sort of an African American basketball
Yes.
head or whatever. What's going on in a story like that? What were you trying to do?
I'll admit I had a bit of fun with that story, and mostly because hair can be quite problematic. And like I think I don't know who I was speaking to someone and saying that what amused me about that story is when we were growing up, when we were in high school, one of the biggest fights we used to have was for us as girls is how long we had to, you know, how long we're allowed to keep our hair. It had to be like an inch or less. And to sort of hear my nieces still talking about it like 30 years later, it's like, wow, you still have that issue going on. So yeah, girls have all, I mean, students have always had something to say about how they want to look and all of that. So yeah, it's a fun kind of story. But at the same time, it's, you know, there are also deeper issues, because when it comes to African girls, women and their hair, it has been problematic in the past. It has been politicized. It's how African women present themselves, what our hair ought to look like, and what is considered presentable. All that has always been problematic. So beyond the lightness, there's a lot of depth to that, that goes back to our own identity, who we are. So in that story, I just have this girl just having fun and just being rebellious and, yeah, just trying to make her mark.
The other thing that strikes me, and it comes in different places, you cleverly insert different strata of society. In that story, you've got the young girl who's being, in a sense, attended by a helper in the house. It's not altogether on side about all of the braiding that has to be done, but she's a relative of some sort, but she appears to be pretty much a servant in the household. Is that right? And I'm thinking that's probably part of the complexity of society. There's middle class society that comes through the book. There's other parts of it where people are from much closer to the bottom of the social strata.
When I was writing this, I actually had a Kenyan audience in mind, and I knew they'd recognize that this is normal. Most of us, our idea of family is just not, you know, just the parents and the children. There's always other relatives who live with you. Growing up, we had a series, you know, we had quite a few relatives come in and go. And sometimes there are those who come, they come and stay for years and they go to school and all of that. And then there are those who, after school, have nowhere to go or feel like, I mean, just need maybe to help you with your work or whatever. So there's always somebody around, and sometimes there are those who are employed to help around the household, or they just want to do their part in helping out. So so that is pretty, I think, can I say almost normal for us in a Kenyan household. So yeah, so it was important to have that, because that sort of completes what a family is.
Slightly different to that is the very first story in the book, Kembo is Home, which is very touching. And it was a beautiful way to start the book, because it's endearing, it's warm. I think it has a happy, happy ending. Tell us about that. Imagine that's a reasonably typical, again, socioeconomic setting, poor family, mother with difficulties, people getting by as best they can, the other families would be much better off.
Well, for a young audience, I just thought that would be a nice way for them to get into the book, because most of us would recognize bullying. It comes in various forms and in every society, regardless of what your background is. So most students should be aware of, or at least have come across that in one form or the other. But that also came from a very personal place. We've got a member of the family who has an intellectual disability, and I drew a lot of what I knew about that character from my experience with her. But one of the things that got me thinking when I was reflecting on that, when I was thinking about that story, is my own family was quite fortunate and we had the resources to be able to look after her. But I'm aware that there are very many more who have members with different forms of disability, and they don't struggle to get medical attention. And But in that case, it's a it's how the community rallies around to help one another in that. So that was at the forefront of my thinking when I was exploring that story.
The second story, One Last Breakfast, I just love, because it went from Kembo to this this next story, and we're dealing with people from Burundi.
Yeah.
and we're dealing with people who are diplomats, and we're dealing with political turmoil and people who become stateless. And I'm sitting here thinking, wow, we're into refugee law here, but apparently you're a refugee if you don't have a country to seek refuge from. What inspired a story like that? It's a lovely story.
Well, the very first story I wrote that isn't part of this collection was I was looking at internally displaced peoples. But for this one, I was thinking, okay, how do you process being made homeless and stateless if you're not a poor person? Because it's a different reality for them, you know? It's still hard. It still happens to them, but it hits differently because they already have the resources and a network of people who can support them. But I don't even know what inspired me to write that story. It's been a while now. But I do remember that when I was growing up, you'd hear stories of what Idi Amin had done. And he woke up one day and decided all Asians have been, you know, are going to be kicked out of Uganda. And suddenly they find themselves stateless. So, yeah, I remember that. I remember that part of the history when I was writing that. Yeah.
What I liked about it was I was being introduced as a reader with limited knowledge about, in broad terms, as I said earlier, the geopolitics of the area. But there you are. You're suddenly finding different ethnic groups as you go through. Mm-hmm. Then you've got those themes. As you say, there's the bullying in the Kembo story. But then you have some domestic violence happening, don't you?
Mm-hmm. In which one? Oh.
I'm thinking of an infusion of masala tea.
Oh, yeah, of course. I thought we were still talking about One Last Breakfast. Yeah, that is one that is, I don't want to say it's common, but it is also common here in Australia. You read about it in the news and it happens. Yeah, so it's just one way of processing. Because when I was thinking about just the different social justice issues I wanted to think of, there are those that happen in the home, there are those that happen, you know, there are political issues, economic ones. And, you know, when you come back into the home, that is another one that hits quite hard. Yeah.
You mentioned politics, and this is why I loved it. It wasn't a wild ride. It was such a well-measured ride. I'm going around Kenya. I'm being introduced to some other issues here and there. But I was both bemused and confused when I read Vote Bahati by Two. So we've got the son and the mother and all this stuff going on, and a younger brother, I think. I'm thinking that probably has some, in a very broad sense, context in reality. Explain to our listeners what you're doing.
It's called Vote Bahati times two because he's named twice, Bahati Bahati.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yes. Because in some cultures, you name your child after the eldest son. I mean, the eldest son after your father, and then the second child after the maternal grandfather, things like that. So sometimes you end up with children with double names like that, like in that case. But that was just one of those situations where power resides with families. If the family is influential, they get the power, and it's very hard to unseat them because it sort of gets passed on. It's quite an interesting situation because we do get a lot of instances like that where somebody retires and their son becomes the next leader. I mean, we've had the first president of Kenya who was Kenyatta, and then the third president was his son. You know, it is a very, we almost expect that power resides in families. And I just wanted to explore that a little bit, and how corruption comes in when it comes to politics and how we do our politics. Yeah.
The readers are going to really enjoy working their way through it. And I can certainly recommend you can start at the beginning and just keep reading. It's it's delightful. And all of these different stories come out at you. it's probably a good time to go in that sense to the lead story. I am mm-hmm. the power, as I say, for me, having worked in native title law in Australia. The lessons there really resonated. People losing their ancestral country, the government basically putting up signs and notices, and the transmission of cultural knowledge, and then people coming back to it, but having been given responsibilities by their elders to do the right thing in a changing world, I suppose, where the boy goes off to be educated. It's a powerful story with a very powerful footnote after the African courts, which I wasn't aware of, and just a year ago and made a ruling. Tell our listeners about that. Was that an area of controversy in Kenya?
It has been. Round about the time I was reading it, it was constantly in the headlines. The Mau Forest is one of the biggest forests in Africa, and it's a great catchment area for rain, if I can call it that. And for a long time, the forest was getting depleted. And at some point when it was decided that, okay, we need to save this forest, and it was getting depleted because there was big companies, you know, there was timber factories happening there. There was a huge tea plantation that's associated with some of the leaders, the great leaders there. And so as the forest was diminishing, when it was decided that it's time to do something to save and rehabilitate the forest, the people who struggled the most, or the first people to be evicted out of the forest, were the Ogiekes. So that story is actually, I took a lot of ideas and a lot of the words from the Ogiek themselves, because it was an ongoing thing when I was writing this, and because it's not my own community as such, I didn't want to misrepresent their position. And so I think it's probably the only story where I took the words out of the news sources. Yes, just listening to their interviews. And in fact, there's a line there that I thought was really powerful. There was an elder in that group, and who, you know, in their conversations with the government, you know, in their debates, and they were saying, "We are not destroying the forest. We know how to live with the forest. We are beekeepers. So their way of life does not threaten the forest in any way." And just watching that irony, that the people who are doing the least harm to the forest were the ones who were suffering the most. All this time when they were being ejected out of the Mau, the big companies, the logging companies, were there. The tea plantations, they're there, you know? So it's a bitter story. It's difficult, but it's a fight that is ongoing. And though that was ruled, we wait to see how effective the ruling from the African court is going to be. But what I also enjoyed about that story was I learned so much about it. Even the whole concept of conservation refugees, there's a huge push everywhere to conserve this and conserve that, but there's always people who are particularly indigenous to a place, and the spot of land they're on is very important to them. It's part of their cultural identity. They're the ones who are getting, you know, the hard end of this stick. So it was a beautiful story for me to write, because I learned so much. And to date, I still enjoy reading it. I get surprised when I read it. I wonder who wrote it, because I'll be honest, there is a rhythm to it. I don't know whether you sense it, but I read it and I feel like, wow, there is a rhythm. It seems to flow quite well. So, and I thoroughly enjoy it. I think it's probably the one that I've read so many times.
It is a beautiful story. It's mm-hmm. it's sense apocryphal. It's almost like a poem, and it has this amazing real world end. It makes me want to know much more, perhaps on another occasion, about the African Court of Human and People's Rights. I gather only 8 countries have actually subscribed to submit their governments to its rulings, and just how effective that is, I'm not sure, particularly from your comment. But move from the politics of that to the Westgate story, a four-part story. That leaves one feeling a little unnerved, Chemeche. What is going on there?
That's also another thing that happened while I was writing the story. You know, we had this, there was a terrorist attack that happened in Nairobi.
We all remember it, unfortunately.
Yes, yes. So that was, so whilst that was happening, you know, I was thinking, how do you respond to this? Why is this happening? Why are young people being used like this? And so it's in questioning that I wanted to write stories that sort of question that. And I was relying more on how the community responded to that situation. Yeah, so it's slightly different, but it was topical at the time when I was writing it.
Well, it is. It asks all sorts of questions about how people get caught up in events, why they do, and it's challenging. I mean, the world, it seems, humans are always in constant revolution, and the idea of human rights and people's rights is something we tend to struggle with. We pay lip service to it very often. When it's turned into actualities, people struggle with it. What is the reception of human and people's rights in Kenya these days?
Well, I don't live there now, but yes, but I'm in constant touch with my friends and family. When it comes to certain ones, like, you know, the right to education and health and things like that, it's quite positive, even though the resources aren't always there to support that. But I think the biggest conflict is when it comes to cultural rights, the right for women, even for women to own property, that has come a long, long way. And more women are beginning to occupy spaces where, you know, they can enjoy their own rights and help their own communities and enjoy those rights as well. But it's a work in progress. There are some situations that, you know, there are certain rights that we struggle to talk about, you know, or even consider them rights at all, such as sexual rights. So that one is a difficult conversation to have anytime, because they are, when health, education, and things like that take priority.
One thing that certainly comes through in the book for me is the power of women in society, however difficult it is for them to assert themselves. But your final story, The Weaving Circle, as a lovely feel. It was an interesting way to round the book off. Did you have to think hard about how to finish?
No, women are strong. Kenyan women particularly are strong. I come from a family of, there's 8 girls in my own family, you know, and they're all very, very strong women. So it wasn't hard to write about the strong women, you know, I'm surrounded by them. That was a slightly different story, because that I was inspired by a collection of an installation of craft that was at John Curtin Library. What is it called? John Curtin. Oh, it just slipped my mind. The gallery. And yes. there was this art installation there. And, you know, we went to have a look, and, you know, we'd been invited to respond to that. And I thought, okay, I'll respond in a form that was familiar to me, which was fiction. But what I know of the Taita women, you know, the bags that we make, it's always a communal affair. It reminded me of growing up and watching women work together, you know, whether it's to do hair or to make baskets. There's always that sense of community. And you'll probably see a lot of that throughout the stories. So that wasn't a difficult one to write. I just had to take my mind back and just remember how women work together. And it's in those moments of working together that, you know, the stories come out, you know, how they do life, what's happening in their families, how they support each other, and all of that. Yeah. A beautiful spirit.
Well, we're reaching the end of this podcast. I really, as I've said, love this book. It made me want to inquire further, but I just loved each story as a self-contained piece in the book. And I loved how it went this way and went that, and different topics came up. And as I say, it seems to me it's not just for young adults, whatever that means, but they'll love it too. And what about a Kenyan readership? Do you expect that this will find its way to your old home?
I hope so, because that's who I was writing for. When every line of it, I kept imagining the kind of classroom that I'd taught in, and I would imagine this classroom of my own nieces and nephews and the kind of conversations I wanted to have with them. So I wrote with that in mind. But of course, during that process, as I got published here, in a sense, I'm glad that I was writing with a Kenyan audience in mind. I think it helped me be a bit more authentic and just be free with the way I wrote, with the language and all of that. And I was incorporating, you know, whether it was Swahili or whatever that language, because it's very natural for us who speak more than one language to just go between the different languages without even thinking about it. What was the question again?
Well, I'd assume that it would find its way to Kenya. There'd be
people
wanting to read it, but it also would inform and enlighten and make even more curious a similar readership here in Australia. I mean, if you did put it on a high school curriculum, it strikes me.
I think so. It will work beautifully, because every single story will find relevance somewhere here. Because even if it's a unique story such as beating that happens so far away, some things are worth learning about, and just understanding that the world is not the same for everyone. And then there are stories that people can easily relate to that's happening here. Even the lead story, I am the Mao. You know, we can find lots of examples where big governments or big businesses have interfered with the lives of Indigenous people. So there is a lot that any reader anywhere on this planet can find, it because it is, after all, about human rights, and human rights is about human stories.
It is, and all literature, the way I see it, all good literature seems to come back to that human rights question. Yeah. What comes next for you?
I'm yet to figure that out. Right now, I'm excited, but I've dreamed of having a book out there. It's out now. I'm just taking it in for the moment, and let's see how we go. Yes.
Congratulations on I Am the Mao. I think people are going to love this, and it's been really lovely talking to you. Thanks for meeting me today.
Well, thanks, Michael. This has just been wonderful. Thank you so much. And thanks for reading my work. Thanks for enjoying it. And because it just gives me such pleasure. It's one thing to write it. It's another thing for somebody to actually read it and appreciate it. So thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. Thank you so much.